Chapter 10. Soon. Do you know your way to where you came from? You let me go, returned the boy, suddenly twisting out of his grasp. I'm not a going to take you there. Let me be, or I'll heave some fire at you. He was down before it, and ready, with his savage little hand, to pluck the burning coals out. What the chemist had felt, in observing the effect of his charmed influence stealing over those with whom he came in contact, was not nearly equal to the cold vague terror with which he saw this baby monster put it at defiance. It chilled his blood, to look on the immovable impenetrable thing, in the likeness of a child, with its sharp malignant face turned up to his, and its almost infant hand, ready at the bars. Listen, boy. He said, you shall take me where you please, so that you take me where the people are very miserable or very wicked. I want to do them good, and not to harm them. You shall have money, as I have told you, and I will bring you back. Get up. Come quickly. He made a hasty step towards the door, afraid of her returning. Will you let me walk by myself, and never hold me, nor yet touch me? Said the boy, slowly withdrawing the hand with which he threatened, and beginning to get up. I will. And let me go, before, behind, or any ways I like. I will. Give me some money first, then, and go. The chemist laid a few shillings, one by one, in his extended hand. To count them was beyond the boy's knowledge, but he said one, every time, and avariciously looked at each as it was given, and at the donor. He had nowhere to put them, out of his hand, but in his mouth, and he put them there. Redlaw then wrote with his pencil on a leaf of his pocketbook that the boy was with him, and laying it on the table, signed to him to follow. Keeping his rags together, as usual, the boy complied, and went out with his bare head and naked feet into the winter night. Preferring not to depart by the iron gate by which he had entered, where they were in danger of meeting her whom he so anxiously avoided, the chemist led the way, through some of those passages among which the boy had lost himself, and by that portion of the building where he lived, to a small door of which he had the key. When they got into the street, he stopped to ask his guide, who instantly retreated from him, if he knew where they were. The savage thing looked here and there, and at length, nodding his head, pointed in the direction he designed to take. Redlaw going on at once, he followed, something less suspiciously, shifting his money from his mouth into his hand, and back again into his mouth, and stealthily rubbing it right upon his shreds of dress, as he went along. Three times, in their progress, they were side by side. Three times they stopped, being side by side. Three times the chemist glanced down at his face, and shuddered as it forced upon him one reflection. The first occasion was when they were crossing an old churchyard, and Redlaw stopped among the graves, utterly at a loss how to connect them with any tender, softening, or consolatory thought. The second was when the breaking forth of the moon induced him to look up at the heavens, where he saw her in her glory, surrounded by a host of stars he still knew by the names and histories which human science has appended to them. But where he saw nothing else he had been wont to see, felt nothing he had been wont to feel, in looking up there, on a bright night. The third was when he stopped to listen to a plaintive strain of music, but could only hear a tune, made manifest to him by the dry mechanism of the instruments and his own ears, with no address to any mystery within him, without a whisper in it of the past, or of the future, powerless upon him as the sound of last year's running water, or the rushing of last year's wind. At each of these three times, he saw with horror that, in spite of the vast intellectual distance between them, and their being unlike each other in all physical respects, the expression on the boy's face was the expression on his own. They journeyed on for some time now through such crowded places, that he often looked over his shoulder thinking he had lost his guide, but generally finding him within his shadow on his other side. Now I lay so quiet that he could have counted his short, quick naked footsteps coming on behind until they arrived at a ruinous collection of houses, and the boy touched him and stopped. "In there," he said, pointing out one house, where there were shattered lights in the windows, and a dim lantern in the doorway, with lodgings for travelers painted on it. Redlaw looked about him, from the houses to the waste piece of ground on which the houses stood, or rather did not altogether tumble down, unfenced, undrained, unlighted, and be ordered by a sluggish ditch, from that, to the sloping line of arches, part of some neighboring viaduct or bridge with which it was surrounded, and which lessened gradually towards them, until the last, but one was a mere kennel for a dog, the last a plundered little heap of bricks, from that, to the child, close to him, cowering and trembling with the cold, and limping on one little foot, while he coiled the other round his leg to warm it, yet staring at all these things with that frightful likeness of expression, so apparent in his face, that Redlaw started from him. "In there," said the boy, pointing out the house again. "I'll wait." "Will they let me in?" asked Redlaw. "Say you're a doctor," he answered with a nod. "There's plenty ill here." Looking back on his way to the house door, Redlaw saw him trail himself upon the dust, and crawl within the shelter of the smallest arch, as if he were a rat. He had no pity for the thing, but he was afraid of it, and when it looked out of its den at him, he hurried to the house as a retreat. "Sorrow, wrong, and trouble," said the chemist, with a painful effort at some more distinct remembrance, "at least haunt this place darkly. He can do no harm, who brings forgetfulness of such things here." With these words, he pushed the yielding door, and went in. There was a woman sitting on the stairs, either asleep or forlorn, whose head was bent down on her hands and knees. As it was not easy to pass without treading on her, and as she was perfectly regardless of his near approach, he stopped, and touched her on the shoulder. Looking up, she showed him quite a young face, but one whose bloom and promise were all swept away, as if the haggard winter should unnaturally kill the spring. With little or no show of concern on his account, she moved nearer to the wall, to leave him a wider passage. "What are you?" said Redlaw, pausing, with his hand upon the broken stair rail. "What do you think I am?" she answered, showing him her face again. He looked upon the ruined temple of God, so lately made, so soon disfigured, and something, which was not compassion for the springs in which a true compassion for such miseries as its rise, were dried up in his breast, but which was nearer to it, for the moment, than any feeling, that had lately struggled into the darkening, but not yet wholly darkened, night of his mind, mingled a touch of softness with his next words. "I am come here to give relief, if I can," he said. "Are you thinking of any wrong?" She frowned at him, and then laughed, and then her laugh prolonged itself into a shivering sigh, as she dropped her head again, and hid her fingers in her hair. "Are you thinking of a wrong?" he asked once more. "I am thinking of my life," she said, with a momentary look at him. He had a perception that she was one of many, and that he saw the type of thousands, when he saw her, drooping at his feet. "What are your parents?" he demanded. "I had a good home once. My father was a gardener, far away, in the country." "Is he dead?" "He's dead to me. All such things are dead to me. You a gentleman, and not know that." She raised her eyes again, and laughed at him. "Girl," said Redlaw, sternly, "before this death, of all such things, was brought about, was there no wrong done to you? In spite of all that you can do, does no remembrance of wrong cleave to you? Are there not times upon times, when it is misery to you?" So little of what was womanly was left in her appearance, that now, when she burst into tears, he stood amazed. But he was more amazed, and much disquieted, to note that in her awakened recollection of this wrong, the first trace of her old humanity and frozen tenderness appeared to show itself. He drew a little off, and in doing so, observed that her arms were black, her face cut, and her bosom bruised. What brutal hand has hurt you so? He asked. My own. I did it myself, she answered quickly. It is impossible. I'll swear I did. He didn't touch me. I did it to myself in a passion, and threw myself down here. He wasn't near me. He never laid a hand upon me. In the white determination of her face, confronting him with this untruth, he saw enough of the last perversion and distortion of good surviving in that miserable breast, to be stricken with remorse, that he had ever come near her. Sorrow, wrong, and trouble, he muttered, turning his fearful gaze away. All that connects her with the state from which she has fallen, has those roots. In the name of God, let me go by. Afraid to look at her again, afraid to touch her, afraid to think of having sundered the last thread by which she held upon the mercy of heaven, he gathered his cloak about him, and glided swiftly up the stairs. Opposite to him, on the landing, was a door, which stood partly open, and which, as he ascended, a man with a candle in his hand, came forward from within to shut. But this man, on seeing him, drew back, with much emotion in his manner, and, as if by a sudden impulse, mentioned his name aloud. In the surprise of such a recognition there, he stopped, endeavoring to recollect the wan and startled face. He had no time to consider it, for, to his yet greater amazement, old Philip came out of the room, and took him by the hand. Mr. Redlaw, said the old man, this is like you, sir, you have heard of it, and have come after us to render any help you can. Ah, too late, too late. Redlaw, with a bewildered look, submitted to be led into the room. A man lay there, on a truckle bed, and William Swidger stood at the bedside. Too late, murmured the old man, looking wistfully into the chemist's face, and the tears stole down his cheeks. That's what I say, father, interposed his son in a low voice. That's where it is, exactly. To keep as quiet as ever we can, while he's a-dozing, is the only thing to do. You're right, father. Redlaw paused at the bedside, and looked down on the figure that was stretched upon the mattress. It was that of a man, who should have been in the vigor of his life, but on whom it was not likely the sun would ever shine again. The vices of his 40 or 50 years' career had so branded him, that, in comparison with their effects upon his face, the heavy hand of time upon the old man's face who watched him had been merciful and beautifying. Who is this? Asked the chemist, looking round. My son George, Mr. Redlaw, said the old man, wringing his hands. My eldest son, George, who was more his mother's pride than all the rest. Redlaw's eyes wandered from the old man's gray head, as he laid it down upon the bed, to the person who had recognized him, and who had kept aloof, in the remotest corner of the room. He seemed to be about his own age. And although he knew no such hopeless decay and broken man as he appeared to be, there was something in the turn of his figure, as he stood with his back towards him, and now went out at the door, that made him pass his hand uneasily across his brow. William, he said in a gloomy whisper, who is that man? Why you see, sir, returned Mr. William, that's what I say, myself. Why should a man ever go and gamble, and the like of that, and let himself down inch by inch till he can't let himself down any lower? Has he done so? Asked Redlaw, glancing after him with the same uneasy action as before. Just exactly that, sir, returned William Swidger, as I'm told. He knows a little about medicine, sir, it seems. And having been wayfaring towards London with my unhappy brother, that you see here, Mr. William passed his coat sleeve across his eyes, and being lodging upstairs for the night, what I say, you see, is that strange companions come together here sometimes he looked in to attend upon him, and came for us at his request. What a mournful spectacle, sir! But that's where it is. It's enough to kill my father. Redlaw looked up, at these words, and, recalling where he was and with whom, and the spell he carried with him which his surprise had obscured, retired a little, hurriedly, debating with himself, whether to shun the house that moment, or remain. Yielding to a certain sullen doggedness, which it seemed to be a part of his condition to struggle with, he argued for remaining. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.